Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio Free Pre Liberties Current Affairs Podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis Podcast and Radio Free Pre Liberties Media Manager here in Washington, D.C. Okay, so this week we are here to talk about Uzbekistan, and there are many reasons why we are focusing on this country in this particular discussion. Let's start with the good news. The news is that the State Department has removed Uzbekistan from the watch list of countries for possible violation of religious freedoms. Second, on December 10th, the world marked International Human Rights Day, and there have been certainly positive developments in this field during President Mirziyayev's term in the office, who is about to complete his fourth year as the president. Though there are good stories to be shared about Uzbekistan, but activists on the ground also tell us that we need to control our excitement because the situation is far from being ideal. So we are here to look into some of the needy, greedy details about the progress and talk about what yet remains to be done in Uzbekistan as the president is marking an important milestone in his term in the office. To do so, I'm joined by Dilmira Matyakubova, researcher, co-director of Uz Investigations. She's also Foreign Policy Center Research Fellow, advocate for governance, policy, human rights, and civil liberties. Also from Tashkent, we have human rights attorney Steve Sverdlo, who has been really, you know, our eyes and ears on the ground as these changes were taking place in Uzbekistan. And Steve is joining us from Tashkent today. And from Washington, D.C., I have Kelly Bakken. She is a Central Asia analyst at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And Bruce Panier, the editor of Freedom Free Pre Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Bruce is joining us from Prague. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So let's start with the latest news about Uzbekistan being dropped from the list of countries under the watch list by the State Department. Steve, you are on the ground. You know, you have been following this situation on the ground for a long time. So it was rather a sort of surprise to me when I saw this report. So tell us, what do you think? Are we there yet?
We're not there yet. The honeymoon is definitely over. I think this is a time to examine the facts and to examine what has gone right in the past 4 years and what has gone wrong. And while I'm not one that agrees with the camp that says that all the improvements are completely superficial and that nothing has changed, nor am I really in the camp that says this is purely a modernizing authoritarian system, I do think there are genuinely real good signs that have to be encouraged.
Okay,
so, I also think need to be vigilant and interrogate the facts.
So just to inject one thing there, Steve, so what does this report suggest to you? I mean, what does this report tell to you?
Well, the report, I think, is on its face, it's recognizing certain progress in the areas of registration of Christian communities. It recognizes that there have been steps in this new law that's about to be adopted, which would reduce the number of persons required to actually register a religious community from, for example, from 100 people to 50 people. And there have been some other areas in which certainly religious believers have been taken off the so-called black lists in the past years. There used to be a list where, you know, if you were considered a religious extremist, and in many cases that was really just to be a religious Muslim in Uzbekistan, then you had to report to the police station, let's say twice a month. That has changed. There have been certain improvements in the area of religious freedom. While that is the case, we also know that there are still really thousands of individuals in prison who shouldn't be there, largely on religious grounds. And nothing has really fundamentally changed when it comes to the basic question of how do you choose your religion and how do you practice your religion. That is still very much something that is firmly within the remit of the authorities to decide for you.
I certainly have a couple of other questions stemmed from what you just said, Steve. But before that, Dilmira, you are also on the ground. Of course, your real focus is human rights. We will get to it shortly. But in terms of the religious freedom, as an activist on the ground, what was your firsthand impression when you heard of the decision like Uzbekistan being dropped from this watch list?
Well, that was an interesting development, I think, we are observing now. Well, to me, it's basically, I think, another act of endorsement of the current government's so-called reforms. I know I have a different position when it comes to reforms. There have been loud statements on that, the Uzbekistan have irreversible, remarkable reforms. But I'll tell you one thing, there are two realities we observe here, the reality that the government has and the reality that the people have on the ground. So if you listen to government officials or diplomats, whoever, you know, back the government, they would say, oh, they're remarkable reforms, they are irreversible, so on and so on. And Pompeo stating that there have been significant progresses, I think it's too early to come to this conclusion yet and to lift Uzbekistan from this specialist on religious freedom. And I think we have to also remember the cases from the past, recent past, that the students, well, one student particularly at the International Islamic Academy was dismissed for just wearing a hijab, so expressing her religious belief, right? And then at the same time, you want to promote religious education, but you are violating individual rights, like dismissing student, you know, for expression of her kind of belief. And I think here we have to be really careful when we talk about violation of religious rights, because the state's position is very important and it has to be clear. If constitutionally it wants to be separate from the religion, and it has to make it in practice very clear that it does not meddle with religious associations or communities, as it says in the Constitution, Article 61, that state should be separate from the religion. So that is how I see it.
Right, right. Okay. Kelly, I have to clarify first that this is not the commission's report with which you are affiliated. However, you guys play some role in designations like this. So some technical questions here. So Uzbekistan, not in a very distant past, used to be among the list of countries of particular concern in terms of religious freedom. Then it was removed some time ago from that list. Now it is also removed from the watch list, which is a great success for the reputation of Uzbekistan, the authorities. But what does this designation technically even mean?
Yeah, so I don't think that this decision from the State Department was especially surprising. I do think that we saw some signs that it was kind of moving in this direction. You know, as you mentioned, you know, the State Department first, you know, delisted Uzbekistan from its countries of particular concern list, which are essentially the, you know, considered the worst of the worst in terms of violators of religious freedom back in 2018. And then, you know, it kept them on the special watch list in 2019. Prior to that, of course, you know, the State Department had long designated Uzbekistan as a CPC from 2006 to 2017. Now, as to the differences, you know, between USERF's assessment, we have, you know, differed in our position on Uzbekistan. You know, similar to the State Department, we had also long recommended Uzbekistan for CPC status, you know, beginning in 2005. But when the state decided to upgrade Uzbekistan from CPC to the special watch list in 2018, USERF continued to recommend CPC status. So, I mean, although we recognize the initial, you know, positive progress that was being made, in our view, Uzbekistan was still committing violations that meet that systematic, ongoing, and egregious standard that's used to determine a CPC status. And that was really the case until our latest report came out in April, and for the first time in 15 years, we recommended that Uzbekistan not be designated a CPC and instead be placed on the special watch list. So, I mean, of course, it was somewhat disappointing to see state not follow USERF's recommendation, but they don't necessarily take up all of our recommendations, and they often, you know, take into account other considerations, such as, you know, the bilateral relationship when making those decisions that, you know, frankly, USERF does not. You know, we're solely focused on, you know, religious freedom violations. So I don't think it's altogether surprising that they did this. I think it was in recognition of the progress that they have made, but USERF expects, you know, a little bit more to be done and for the level of these violations to decrease before, you know, we make that similar recommendation.
Yeah, you know, I know when next time Uzbek authorities will come to Washington, D.C., how they are going to present this decision by the State Department. They are very PR savvy in that sense. But from that perspective, the thing is, though, Kelly, I thought this report to be one way to hold Uzbekistan accountable for the things that they still need to improve. Now, how we are going to differentiate, let's say, Uzbekistan from Greenland, in terms of the religious freedom practices. Is the report kind of saying that, you know, they are on the same level, on the same page? Because I don't see any other category. Like, one is this particular concern list, and the other was like a watch list. Is there any other list in which we can differentiate a situation in Uzbekistan from Greenland, for instance?
I mean, USERF's report aside, the State Department itself also will continue to still report on religious freedom conditions in Uzbekistan. Similar to USERF, the State Department also, well, actually, the State Department puts out IRF reports on every country basically in the world, whereas USERF only focuses on the most egregious for our reporting purposes. So there will still be extensive reporting on religious freedom conditions in Uzbekistan that you could, you know, look at, even though, you know, for the State Department's purposes, they won't be included on either the CPC or the special watch list. You can still look at the facts and details included in those reports to determine what kind of violations are happening.
Okay. Yeah, Steve, yeah, please jump in. I just got a message from you. I like when the discussion is kind of interactive.
Let me just say that I've spent the last several weeks speaking with the relatives of people currently imprisoned for so-called religious extremism. And in many cases, we're talking hundreds to potentially more than 2,000 cases, we really have strong indications that these are people that were imprisoned under torture, in closed trials. And in many cases, these were people arrested 20 years ago at the height of the repression of the Karimov era in 1999 after the bombings in Tashkent, when the government really had a field day with so-called terrorists. And while the government in the last 4 years has released a significant number of people, and we know mostly about the human rights defenders and the journalists and some of the political activists that have been released, about 50 to 60 of those, we know a lot less about how many of the religious prisoners are still there. And what I've uncovered is that there are a lot of these people that still, you could argue, Uzbekistan still has the largest population of religious prisoners across the entire former Soviet space. And that's a pretty big mark on your record of religious freedom. So I've been urging the government to deal with that issue, to be transparent, to at least be clear about how many have been released and how many are still there. And as Keeley says, I mean, let me go a little bit further in that I'm not working in the government. I can say that I think there was an element of politics here, you know, between an outgoing administration, a Trump administration, which has largely focused on a sort of transactional business relationship. And I think that an outgoing parting gift, so to speak, was to upgrade Uzbekistan in this way. And while it might certainly reflect some improvements that, you know, we can all agree have taken place in some ways, I think there's something to be said. I think the way in which this has happened kind of undermines the seriousness, as you said, Mohammed, of this ranking, which really is important. And you're right, there is a huge difference between Greenland and Uzbekistan when it comes to religious freedom. So I just wanted to mention the element of criminal justice, which is still very central to this.
Yeah, on this though, Ms. Brusia, I know you are kind of quiet today, but also jump in whenever the time is right for you. So follow up on just you said, Steve, how we hold Uzbekistan accountable after this stage. So I'm asking this question regardless of the transactional type of relationships. What I'm saying is, like, when the authorities, let's say, punish another Yahuwah's witness next time, or maybe when they confiscate religious materials when they try to bring in from outside of the country, is there any other mechanism through which we can hold Uzbek authorities accountable?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, ideally, and I'll let others jump in on this, but I just want to say that, you know, ideally you would have locally registered human rights organizations able to bring those issues to light. And of course, we'll get to that issue that they have not been registered, and that's a very big problem. And I was just at a conference with the Ombudsman for Human Rights in Uzbekistan, and an activist took me aside, a civil society activist, and said, we're kind of in a strange period where we're hearing, as Dilmira said earlier, a lot of diplomats really praising Uzbekistan. And now the activists that are inside the country that used to be forced to praise the government are now critical of the government. And they're wondering, you know, where is the criticism from the international community to hold our government accountable for the things that they aren't yet doing right? So I think you've hit the nail on the head that there need to be these mechanisms of scrutiny, and it's too early for them to go away. We need more eyes on the ground, not less.
Right.
And okay. I would also just jump in on that. So USERF makes recommendations for, you know, either the CPC status or special watch list inclusion, but we also make other additional policy recommendations to the U.S. government. different parts of the government, you know, between either the State Department or Congress. So, you know, over the course of the last year, we've actually been really pleased to see the U.S. government, you know, really taking up some of those recommendations and engaging with them. One of them was to work closely with the government of Uzbekistan to revise its, you know, restrictive religion law and bring that into compliance with international norms. So we've seen a lot of engagement on that. And then our second one, too, which is for the U.S. government to also engage in advocacy for specific religious prisoners. And we've seen, you know, the IRF office and the State Department and Ambassador Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, and take those cases up as well. So there are definitely other means beyond just the, you know, special watch list or CPC designation.
It's good to know, Kaylee. Thank you very much. So, Bruce, as we were kind of focused on the latest report, but I'm sure that Europeans, other Western countries, have their own way to assess the situation on the ground, how they have been assessing the situation in Uzbekistan through their reports, the remarks that you might have followed.
Well, I mean, obviously they mention it, and the European Union has really upped its upped its game in Central Asia. They've been having a series of meetings and conferences with Central Asian officials. This is something that's raised, of course. I think one of the interesting things, or at least as I was trying to figure out why would the U.S. State Department drop them from the list, and what was this all about? And I kept thinking, is it so much better? And I've looked at Forum 18, and we know Felix Corley, he's been on the show before, yeah. And he still, you know, reports a lot of problems going on there. So it's clear that the situation, I agree that it's better than it was, that's right, for sure. But it's far from ideal at the same time. And I think this was, same with the European Union. They don't say a whole lot about it, because this is one area where Uzbekistan has made some progress. But publicly, and at least recently, there's not a lot of reports that contradict, you know, the narrative that there's progress in religious freedoms, as opposed to, say, media freedom, right? Mm-hmm. Where they've been, you know, the government's been taken to task. Even the U.S. ambassador, complained about the problems with media freedom in Uzbekistan. So this is something they promised, but there's clearly been some progress but then regression. Whereas the religious freedom issue is, like I said, that it's significant. They released thousands of Muslims from prison. They have eased up. You don't see the kind of reports of people being arrested for being members of banned religious groups. It used to almost exclusively be Islamic, but you don't see those kind of reports lately, you know, in the recent months and stuff. That might be because of lockdown. I don't know. But so this was kind of an easier issue to deal with, to give them some praise, you know, and say, at least in my opinion, and say, yes, you've made progress, and we're recognizing this by, you know, dropping you from the list, because there really hasn't been much regression in religious freedom, you know, from the moves that they've made. As I said, it's far from ideal.
That's interesting. That's an interesting point. Delmira, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, without major reports and giving this status to Uzbekistan and lifting it from the list, again, calling it a significant progress. How do you measure significant progress if you don't have, again, a substantial facts and reports from the ground? I think, you know, to me, it's just purely a product and result of a good PR in Washington. And as we have been observing within the project of our investigations, my colleagues, the PR is done very smartly by this administration, and it is no secret. And we have evidence to that, to support that. We know that there are agencies like Bridgeway Advocacy in D.C. is on a monthly retainer by public fund for development of mass media in Uzbekistan. And that is a huge thing. That means those people, that agency is involved in reputation laundering, just shortly speaking, because they're there to promote positive changes and good reforms, again, irreversible reforms. This is a catchphrase, actually, among the community who use and promote these reforms. You know, we often hear these phrases. And this is the same song that's sang by this government of, you know, officials and PR agencies, state agencies who are promoting these ideas. Of course, then you get the promotions and endorsements like this one, and giving a certain better rating and improving your position in a World Bank's doing business kind of rating, right? So all actions, all things are done, to me, I mean, as a researcher, by this administration is to improve its image, to rebranding itself, so that in the West or elsewhere, it's seen as a liberal, modernizing, democratizing, state. Mm. Where in fact, in underground, we see right. the opposite.
Right. It's been a really good discussion, and there are comments that people wanting to make. And Bruce, yeah, jump in.
I agree with what Mira said. It's been a totally slick PR campaign that they've run. There's just no doubt about it. But to just add on to what I was saying a minute ago, you know, as is the case with so many things in Uzbekistan, we're comparing with what was a very low base to start with,
yeah.
right?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, what would be baby steps or even insignificant in some countries gets great credit because, you know, it's so different than what Uzbekistan was doing before. But I have to throw in that, in fact, some of the things, for instance, that haven't changed, right, is that all the clerics are state appointed, right? Certainly in Islam, you know, so this is something that hasn't changed at all.
Right.
You know, so they have their own people doing the sermons in the mosque. And another sign, and this is very superficial, but it's telling of the Uzbek government, you know, the beards for young men are still out. You know, Mira mentioned the hijab, you know, was also still problematic. You can't go to school wearing this. So we see that while there's progress, there's some lines that the old Uzbek government drew that you still can't cross or you run into problems immediately. So like I said, it's a very relative statement to say there's been progress because things were so bad, you know, as was the case in forced labor and, you know, and freedom of speech, all that kind of stuff. So
that's
yes, you know, there is progress. But is it, you know, again, if you're a
25-year-old, right?
Then you walk around the street with a beard, you're going to get in a lot of trouble, even if you're not doing anything wrong. I mean, it's that, you know, how paranoid is that?
Yeah. Kaylee wanting to jump in. Yeah, Kaylee.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with what Bruce says about the kind of like the spectrum of what progress means in the context of Uzbekistan. And I can only really speculate as to, you know, the State Department's rationale in its decisions to, you know, recognize this progress in Uzbekistan. But at least for Yusor, you know, in 2019, there were at least, you know, two major developments that really contributed to our decision to no longer recommend them for CPC status. You know, the first was that authorities largely ended the practice of police raids on unregistered religious minority communities. And this is, you know, for a long time, really been a hallmark feature of numerous, you know, USURF annual reports. It was really a huge positive development. And then the second was the decision to close the Jaslik prison, which, you know, as you know, is really notorious for torture and housing religious prisoners. And I'm sure, you know, Steve could probably speak at greater length to that.
There are lots of things that we could be discussing about this aspect of the human rights in Uzbekistan. I just need to move on. But still, I want to give just a microphone to anyone who wants to say anything very briefly in terms of the religious freedom. Then we will move on to the human rights.
You know, I completely agree with Bruce's assessment a minute ago about the low bar and Keely pointing out the raids. You know, that is a real difference. And that's great, you know, of course, that they and all of those small gains, modest gains, it occurs to me that even the fact that, for example, they no longer lengthen sentences arbitrarily for prisoners for 3 or 6 years a month before they're about to be let out on farcical grounds, the only reason those things have taken place is because the human rights community and in some cases the diplomatic community held very, very firm on pushing for those benchmarks. And those were hard fought gains. And, you know, so I think we have to recognize that pressure works and we need to keep at it. One other observation to make is that I think just the attitude towards religion fundamentally, as Bruce just said, it's still so restrictive. And I think it would be a real loss if in this conversation and others, we don't acknowledge that the fundamental right of to exercise one's religion, the state really still controls it and regulates it to such an extent. So if you pray outside of a mosque, if you conduct religious activity in an unregulated space, that's potentially criminal behavior. The concept of what is missionary activity or what is proselytism is still viewed exactly as Bruce was saying before in the way the lines were drawn 20 years ago. Mm. And that's something that hasn't changed, and it really speaks to the effectiveness and the power of that Karimov really imposed on the body politic and has unfortunately sort of been entrenched and is going to take perhaps generations to get free of.
Yeah, let's see. Just to end this part of the discussion on a positive note, for me, one sign of progress is that, Steve, you and Dilmira, you guys are joining us from Tashkent. and talking to us in these terms. I mean, that was never the case in the past. So I just wanted to throw that there. So with that, thank you very much, Stephen, all the other guests. So this was about the religious freedom in Uzbekistan. Now on December 10, we marked the International Day for Human Rights. So what's the report card of Uzbekistan on this aspect as President Mirziyoyev getting ready to complete his fourth year in the office as the president? Let's continue talking about this and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Dilmira Matyakubova, researcher, co-director of UZ Investigations, Steve Sibardlou, associate professor of practice of human rights at the University of Southern California. Steve is also human rights attorney and formerly Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher. He's joining us from Tashkent today. Kelly Bakken, Central Asia analyst at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Bruce Panier, the editor of Araf Yarel's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Bruce is joining us from Prague today. And I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing Uzbekistan in the context of the recent report by the State Department removing Uzbekistan from the list of countries watched for possible religious freedom. On human rights, usually, there are annual reports released marking this day, but I have not seen if there was any in this particular occasion. So on that, Dilmira, let's rely on your verbal report about Uzbekistan's report card on human rights. Tell us how it has been doing throughout 2020 in terms of the human rights.
Well, I must say, from my experience, 2020 has not been a good year. Well, in many aspects, especially on the human rights area, because, well, I study and investigate cases mostly related to urban redevelopment, demolitions, investigating also how corruption is involved in urban governance, urban development. Within those investigations, I must say that we should not separate these issues, you know, like governance, human rights, corruption, kleptocracy, and these are very closely connected areas that we should be discussing, because one affects the other. Wherever you have kleptocracy, you have human rights abuses. Wherever you have corruption, of course you have human rights abuses. It's everywhere. So I must say there has been lots of cases where we observed gross violations of human rights, particularly in the area of demolitions and evictions, forced evictions particularly. Forced eviction itself is a gross violation of human rights according to the international law, but in the national law of Uzbekistan, it's not explicitly explained that this is a violation. So that is solely creating so many problems for people who own property and businesses particularly. Recently, we've been investigating, and soon we'll be publishing a report, an article on a private foreign entity enterprise who is basically practically a victim of conflicts of interest by Tashkent mayor. This is a Ultramark is for an enterprise specializing in mobility equipment, disability wheelchairs. There's, of course, by the government officials who are raising from commercial structures, they're coming with a huge bag of conflicts of interest into the governance. Of course, then you have these problems, and therefore it's very important to have good governance and establish a rule of law. Without these things, you cannot fight for human rights, or you cannot fight corruption.
Right.
So this year particularly, in short, I would say it's been pitiful to observe human rights and to watch and to document. I wouldn't say it's been great, so that's what I'm saying. It's been pitiful, painful, right, observe, experience all this here and well, I can say in many cases, but I don't think we have time for that. So.
Yeah, let's also bring in our other speakers. Steve, so you have been following human rights forever in Uzbekistan. So was 2020 any different to, let's say, to 2019?
Yeah, I mean, I like to begin with, you know, there's no hierarchy or pyramid of human rights. I mean, and as Dilmira said, I think increasingly conversations about corruption, social injustice, lack of transparency coming out and through the forced evictions, which happen in a very, in a way that really violates human rights. I think that's certainly more present in a way in the discussions that you have with people here, especially in Tashkent, that I encounter than before. And a lot can be said about that. But I like to begin with the deprivation of liberty, you know, people who are in prison. And it has to be said that, you know, in September, we saw another four high-profile political prisoners released. That's really important. For example, about 6 years ago, Human Rights Watch did a report on political prisoners. There were 34 of them in that report. And the 34th, the final one, was released in September 2020. In fact, a religious imam, a cleric, Ruhideen Fakhrideenov, who I actually really had serious doubts about whether or not he would ever be released. And so I have to start with that by saying that it is incredibly important that the government is continuing to release prisoners of concern. So I want to start there. But I think, you know, probably the most fruitful area for discussion is freedom of the press. Because, of course, with COVID-19, we saw this all of a sudden, the sort of the darker side of the bureaucracy rearing its ugly head with regard to the media very recently, when the regulator agency, the Agency of Mass Communications and Information, sent letters to Gazeta Uz, Kalamper Uz, Kun Uz, all the major muckraking outlets that have become very vibrant in recent years, and warned them of, quote, serious legal consequences for reporting emotionally on things such as gas outages and electricity outages. And also, I think the implication was that they were challenging the official figures on COVID-19 deaths.
How they determine this reporting emotionally category?
It was striking because it's not based on international standards. And of course, the agency in some ways quickly walked it back when, as Bruce said earlier, the diplomats here on the ground luckily stood up very quickly all in unison and criticized that move. But the fact that it was, you know, that this was done had a chilling effect on the media immediately. And, you know, some of the advocates within the community here, well, this Gongo NGO, whatever you want to call it, this mass media NGO led by the former head of that agency, Kamil Alamjonov, came out with a very interesting statement saying that, in fact, this public spat between the agency and the fact that the newspapers complained about it publicly, that in and of itself showed that progress had been made and that now newspapers and media outlets were able to stand up for themselves. He sort of turned it on its head without recognizing that the government has an obligation not to restrict freedom of speech. And it's a thou shalt not, government shall not restrict freedom of speech. It's not what media outlets must do or how they must act. And so that was a very telling exchange, in a way, probably the most defining of this period of 4 years with the media. I mean, it sort of said that much of what had happened around the media was dependent on this personality of Mr. Alamjonov, who left that agency, and a less savvy, older sort of school person that took that job and decided to use the older tactics of sending a letter and threatening them. And so the hope is that really, you know, this is where we need to draw a line in the sand and make sure the government understands that there will be conditions, there will be consequences for pressure on the press.
Yeah, Bruce, let me bring you in here. Like earlier, you had a very intriguing piece on in terms of the media. So it is interesting the way Steve is describing it, you know, with the examples that you just heard. And it's the authorities' approach. It sounds like, you know, one step forward, one step backward. I mean, how do you evaluate? What is their issue there?
Well, you know, obviously, there's still some topics that are off limits for reporting, unfortunately, you know, and in this case, it did seem to be that they didn't, you know, the authorities, such as they are, didn't want them reporting bad news. The problem a lot of times media runs into, and I suppose, you know, this is like the informal media, right? Social networks and, you know, YouTube, bloggers, people like that. They run into problems with officials all the time, and even members of the regular press corps. The mayor of Tashkent is one. The former mayor of Fergana is another. There's people like that that when there's bad reporting on them, I mean, they bring these people in. In the case of the Tashkent mayor, he's actually threatened to have people disappeared. But, you know, in the former Fergana mayor, Ganiev, you know, he went on a trip and he was insulted by, you know, the locals out there, and one of the guys reported on it. So he decided to arrest a bunch of people. So there's still these officials out there who for some reason are untouchable. And they're kind of like a good barometer of what you can report on and what you can't, because you can see that once people start to question them or hint in some of their posts, reports, whatever, that this official is not so good or that there's problematic, inevitably and quickly they run into problems. So can you report on lower level corruption more than you could 5 or 6 years ago? Yes, you can. But there's some topics that are still, and they're important topics. You know, that's the thing. The government's like, report about corruption so we can find out who these people are and root it out. But then they don't want to know that some people are involved in it. Like I said, low-level officials seem to be fair game. But I can understand the frustration of the media. I think most people that have met with anyone from the media in Uzbekistan, really since independence and stuff, knows that there's people there who, given the opportunity, would be able to report, willing to report on all kinds of really important topics that the country needs to know about, you know, and try to correct. But they've never been given the chance. And now that, you know, the officials are like publicly begging them to report on these topics, then we keep finding out, well, okay, you can't, this is one topic you can't report on. And here's another one that we really don't want you to mention.
No, very, very interesting, you know, the struggle that they have there. Unfortunately, as interesting as it is, the discussion we are having today, but we need to wrap up the discussion very quickly. Just some final thoughts here. Kelly, let me bring you in here. Of course, you might have something to add in terms of discussion that we were having on human rights, but if you do, please feel free to add. My question, though, Kelly, the fact that, you know, some things has changed in Uzbekistan, although baby step, while there are a lot to be desired, it's a kind of future looking discussion. Is there anything we could build on what led to those small progress and to press for more changes?
Sure. I mean, I think going forward, there's definitely a lot of opportunity to continue to build on the progress that we've made so far. We're definitely going to continue to follow the developments surrounding the draft religion law. I mean, Uzbekistan had requested a legal opinion on that from the OSCE and the Venice Commission. So we hope and urge, you know, that they will really consider a lot of the recommendations that they made there, you know, particularly dealing with, you know, issues of mandatory registration, approval of religious literature, and, you know, the ability to share or teach your beliefs. You know, as to the broader human rights discussion, of course, as USERF, you know, we focus very solely really on the religious freedom element. But of course, we recognize the interconnectedness of those rights, you know, freedom of expression and speech and assembly. And I think any improvements in either religious freedom or in those other rights, you know, is a net gain for human rights in general, and, you know, has a mutually reinforcing effect. So hope to continue to see some more progress in the years to come.
Bruce, your thought on that? I was interested in your thoughts about the same question. I mean, is there anything we could build on which really worked and press for more progress?
You know, I think to a large extent that's kind of being done. I'm firm, absolutely an advocate of, when dealing with the Central Asian countries, that when they show any progress at all, you got to note it. You know, and say this is a step in the right direction. Some of that is going on, certainly. In fact, if anything, it might be overplayed a little bit. You know, Steve hinted at that at the start, and so is Mira, that unfortunately they tend to get way too much credit for not really having done all that much. But still, it's important to keep doing that. You know, and pointing out when they make mistakes. Like I said, the State Department drops them from the list of religious freedom violators. You know, but the U.S. ambassador just a couple of weeks ago criticized them for not respecting media freedom. This is pretty much the way it's got to go. It was the way it was in the 90s before pre-9/11, when the relationship was much more, at least for the U.S. and for the West, was much easier of like, we don't really need Uzbekistan for anything, but we want you to progress in what we would consider to be a positive direction for you, your country, and for the world, the international community. You know, and that I'm all for doing that. They seem to be doing some of that right now. So it's hopeful.
Yeah, Stephen, Dilmira, let me ask this question in the opposite terms. So is there any lessons that we should learn from the lack of progress and change our approach as we think the future?
So I might sound pessimistic, I always do, but in terms of the change and real progress, I think you need a better good governance for that. Governance itself is a problem in Uzbekistan, and not only in Uzbekistan, in the context of Central Asia, if we speak, because the governing body as a policy institution does not exist. And I'll explain why. You have a ruling country, ruling state, which dictates, and there's one person and with his circle, political elite, basically, let's call them, political elite dictates rules, but they don't govern. They don't have the habit of governing. So governing is a huge thing if you want to make progress in any area, in human rights, in rule of law or independence, political freedoms and religious freedom. So if you have the right governing body, not the government, I mean, not the chinovniki, not the, what do you call, bureaucrats I'm talking about, the politicians, the member of parliament, the functioning parliament, unless you have that, I don't think you can make any reform or any progress. And you have to have also independent judiciary, independent judges, and separation of power clearly to make a progress. And I don't see that coming in with this. I may sound pessimistic, but these elite in power. And what is this administration is trying to look like is it's trying to look like a little bit of pregnant. We say there is a saying, you can be a little bit of pregnant, you can have a little bit of human rights or a little bit of religious freedom or a little bit of democracy. You either have it or you don't, or you either commit to it or you don't. So there is a complete responsibility and utter commitment and fulfillment of that claim, if you want to claim to be a liberal democratic country state. And you have to do that, and you have to be committed to towards that. And I think I also see a role for international organizations here, like UNOCHR, WUS State Department, or others. Why I say that? Because I think they are not critical enough. Well, this is my purely opinion, my own opinion. I don't think they're being critical enough. Maybe they don't see that it's their job or role or moral care, whatever. But I think that they're more praising the government and not condemning enough the atrocities and human rights violations in the country. I think there is more applauding rather than condemning and acknowledging just the violations. That is what I think. It's the role of international organizations is crucial, as well as the commitment of the administration to the to the change.
Yeah, let's end, Steve, the discussion with your note on that, what Delmira has just said in terms of the role of the international community. So is there anything that didn't work the way it was expected? And is there anything that the international community or the advocates, they need to consider as they come up with their approach in terms of making more progress, making more change in Uzbekistan?
Yeah, I think it's about honing in on, as I was saying in the beginning, examining the facts very closely about what's working and what's not. I think that if there's any lesson, it's that, of course, just as we saw last week when all the embassies spoke in unison about what the agency was doing to the newspapers on freedom of the press, it did elicit a response immediately. It just shows that you need to have principled diplomacy, you need to have consistent messaging, you need to have real consequences for violations of human rights. And I think it's important, as I look forward to 2021, in terms of that checklist that you asked about before, obviously NGO registrations, huge issue. We saw a recent organization got 18 times rejected, a youth organization that tries to help people distribute humanitarian aid. I think another area to mention is domestic violence, which is an epidemic in Uzbekistan. We did see two laws passed in the past year. You did an excellent podcast on it, so I won't go into it too much. But you need critical things like shelters, and you need, again, registration of organizations to be able to work on those things. And torture is still a problem that the UN Committee Against Torture talks about. We still don't have the Red Cross in going into jails, International Committee of the Red Cross. And again, forced labor, still an important issue to stay vigilant, even though there's been progress. So there are a lot of things that need to be worked on. And I think really, to me, the critical piece is without a vibrant media and without independent civil society getting registered and able to work, it's going to be hard to really see major changes as we lead up to another election cycle where, you know, we haven't mentioned this, but no opposition parties. It doesn't look likely that they will be allowed to participate in those elections. And that's a very important thing. And, you know, we had Senator Safayev coming to Washington a few weeks ago, and I think he made the statement that the presidential elections would be completely different than they have been in the past. And I don't know what that meant, but in terms of what it would mean to a human rights activist, it would mean that you need to open up the political space and reduce the role of the security services and allow for, as Dilmir was just saying, not a little bit of democracy, but democracy.
Right. Yeah, just to give a shout out, last week we had a conversation about gender equality and domestic violence. We had Irina Matvienko from Uzbekistan, and she was talking about the challenges to get an NGO registered. As you just reiterated, Steve, I guess it seems to be really a challenge there. With this, I think we need to wrap up the discussion here. Thank you very much, Steve Severlo, human rights attorney and the associate professor of practice of human rights at the University of Southern California. Steve was joining us from Tashkent. And also was joining us from Tashkent is Dilmira Matyakubova, who's the researcher, co-director of UZ Investigations, also Foreign Policy Center Research Fellow, Advocate for Governance, Policy, Human Rights, and Civil Liberties. Kelly Bakken, Central Asia Analyst at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And Bruce Panier, the editor of Freedom for Freedom Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you. Rahmat.
Thank you. Thank you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Ready for Freedom Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week. Bye-bye.